Hi, everybody. This is Gary Sandy, and thank you very much for listening to the WKRP cast.
So just sit right down, relax, open your ears real wide, and say...
Weather today in the greater Cincinnati area.
Are you awake? Whoa! Are you awake now?
But the senator, while insisting he was not intoxicated, could not explain his nudity.
Say what?
Dear God, she's going to kill us all.
Welcome to the WKRP cast. My name is Donna Stair.
And I'm her husband, Alan. This is a week-by-week, episode-by-episode rewatch. We're getting into the music,
the trivia,
and the fun of WKRP.
So, fellow babies, don't touch that dial. It's time for the WKRP cast.
I'm at WKRP in Cincinnati.
Welcome back to another WKRP cast. We're getting classic this week. What's our episode, Donna?
We are ready to discuss Bah Humbug, aired on the 20th of December, 1980, written by Lisa Levin, story editor Lisa Levin, story consultants Steve Marshall and Dan Gunzelman, directed by Rod Daniel. Mr. Carlson eats one of Johnny's special brownies, and he falls asleep at the station. He has a Christmas Carol dream about being a Scrooge for not giving the radio staff a Christmas bonus.
The risk-taking and experimentation of Season 3 continue in this episode. In order to do the special effects of ghosts appearing and disappearing and of Gordon Jump talking to himself, this episode was shot without a studio audience. Most of the effect shots had to be done twice with only one performer on camera at a time. It's hard for an audience to even understand a scene when a performer is talking to the air and you can't hear the response. Noted Canadian and WKRP blogger Roy Penny wanted us to be sure and mention this episode is Andy Ackerman's first ever Emmy nomination and win. Andy Ackerman, who was a major force as both director and editor on Cheers and Seinfeld, among many others, was a videotape editor on WKRP for 62 episodes. He was nominated for Outstanding Videotape Editing for a Series for this episode, and he won at the 1981 awards. WKRP was only nominated for 3 Emmys the entire series, and this was their only win.
Thanks to WKRP cast listener Jim Farrell for dropping us a note. Jim is our favorite kind of listener, a pop culture historian. He pointed out that December 8, 1980, 2 days after the airing of A Mile in My Shoes, John Lennon was assassinated by Mark David Chapman in front of the Dakota Building in New York. As a quiet tribute, a portrait of Lennon will appear on WKRP's set during the Venus and the Man episode later this season.
I had mentioned in Tornado about being in stations during a 10 bell emergency alert. Lennon's shooting was my very first. I'd been working about 4 months. I just turned 16, and I was alone in the station when the UPI machine went off. I ripped the story and I called the news director, and I remember my hands shaking as I dialed. She told me to get it on the air immediately. I stopped the automation system, something we were told to never do, and read the story. It's one of those things you'd never forget.
We would also like to thank L.A. Jamie Schmidt and listener Todd Revord for alerting us to the passing of Linda Carlson. Linda, you might remember, played the hilarious Nikki/Nick Sinclair in Hotel Ocean View. She passed away on October 26th of 2021 at her home in Gaylordsville, Connecticut. Linda was 76 years old.
And all I can think is, it's Nick Sinclair. I just start laughing at that. All right, let's get into the episode. We open in the bullpen where we see Venus mixing a bowl of eggnog. Herb is carving a ham on his desk with Les watching over his shoulder, and Bailey is carrying a plate of cookies. Bailey says her grandmother used to make these very same cookies as she's taking a bite.
I remember tasting this, Bab.
But Les, it's Christmas. You gotta have ham. That's what pigs are for.
Pigs. Poor Les.
Poor Les. He turns and goes back to his desk. Venus is talking to Bailey.
What do you think Carlson's gonna do?
He's going to do the fair thing.
Venus has a laugh over that.
Johnny enters through the studio hallway door carrying a plate of brownies.
Brownie?
Thanks. Who made these?
I did.
Maybe later.
Johnny has a plate of what we would call edibles, food laced with THC. That's the active ingredient in marijuana. These days, with legal weed available throughout the country, pre-packaged edibles with standardized dosing are pretty common. Back in the day, if you wanted an edible, you had to do some baking. You can't get high from eating raw weed. It has to be heated in order to activate the THC.
Humans figured out how to make edibles thousands of years ago, but pot brownies have a much more modern history. The first published recipe for pot brownies appeared in a 1957 memoir/cookbook called The Alice B. Toklas Cookbook. Alice had been the life partner of Gertrude Stein. Stein's best-selling 1933 book, The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, was Stein's joke about Toklas refusing to write her memoirs. Toklas finally wrote her cookbook well after Stein's death. In it was a recipe for something she called hashish fudge. She said it could liven up any gathering.
Oh, yeah.
Although Alice says the recipe was given to her by a friend, her name is forever associated with edibles, especially pot brownies.
Venus puts the brownie back on the plate. Johnny asks Venus what he's heard from Carlson. Venus tells him nothing. Andy enters the bullpen and picks up a glass of eggnog.
Here's the man to ask. How about it, Travis? Is Carlson going to stiff us again this year?
Andy says he doesn't know.
Johnny says Carlson gave them each $25 last year. Then he adds...
People in prison get bigger bonuses than that.
I know.
Herb looks up from his carving.
Herb is really considering this.
I think so. Andy picks up a brownie.
Who made these?
Johnny.
Andy tosses the brownie back onto the plate. Venus walks up to Travis.
Listen, Travis, I got a tiny little gray-haired grandmother at home who's still watching a black and white TV set. Now, before she dies, I want her to see Eight is Enough in color. I mean, that's a dream of mine, and that's why I need that bonus money.
Eight is Enough was an hour-long comedy drama that ran on ABC from March of 1977 until May of 81. It was produced by Lorimar, who were also producing The Waltons at the same time. The two shows had a similar feel, and they even shared writers and producers.
Eight is Enough was based on a book by syndicated newspaper columnist Ton Braden, who had eight kids. Dick Van Patten played Braden, renamed Bradford for the show, along with eight unknown child actors. The series launched acting and music careers for several of its young stars. Most notably was Ralph Macchio, who played Cousin Jeremy 3 years before he would meet Mr. Miyagi.
Wax on, wax off. Herb has to get his plea in as well.
I mean, my poor little daughter has sucked her thumb since infancy. She needs braces, Travis. Her teeth are all over the place. I mean, she's got one over here, and then she got one back here. I just want to fix those teeth. That's what my bonus is for.
Very commendable.
I'm just trying to be the best darn father I can be.
Travis walks up to Bailey.
Oh, come on, Bailey. How about you?
He tells them she thinks grannies and daughters are very touching.
But frankly, I'm in it for the bread, you know what I mean?
And let's not forget Les.
For the last half decade, Mr. Carlson has promised us that when this station reached fiscal soundness, we, the employees, would share in that financial good fortune. Well, my fine feathered friend, that time is now upon us. The chickens have come home to roost. Push has come to shove. The hogs have all gone to market. The cows are out to pasture.
Look, everybody.
Now, we're not going to get into all of Les's phrases, but one did catch our ear. We decided to check out the origin of Fine Feathered Friend. There was a 1937 song by Glenn Miller of that name.
I know you love to fly, my fine feathered friend. Someday you'll fly too high, my fine feathered friend. I know that every birdie has to try his wing. And I can see you're planning, going places, seeing things.
But according to the Word Detective, it's a much older phrase.
Robert Patlock wrote a weird novel in 1751 called The Life and Adventures of Peter Wilkins. In it, Wilkins discovers an underground world inhabited by flying people. Remember, we said it was weird. Wilkins meets and falls in love with one of these flying ladies. He refers to her as being fine-feathered with a hyphen. The hyphen would indicate good-looking feathers. Over the years, the hyphen has been dropped, which changes the meaning from fine feathers to a fine friend who has feathers. Did you follow all that?
Yes, yes. Andy turns from Les and addresses everyone. He tells them he's on their side, but it's Carlson's decision.
Why, he's a very fine, upstanding man with many enduring qualities. I do not think we can forget that he has Genghis Khan for a mother.
Carlson has entered the bullpen just in time to hear Andy say the bit about Genghis Khan.
Who has Genghis Khan for a mother?
I do.
To cover, they all raise their hands, saying they do.
And now a special look at this episode's bandage placement for the 5-time Buckeye NewsHawk Award winner, Les Nessman. This is the Les Nessman Bandage Report. Now, here's Donna Stair with her report about Les Nessman.
Entire right thumb.
This has been a look at the bandage placement for Silver Sow and Copper Cob award-winning journalist, Les Nessman. Andy mentioned Genghis Khan, which is kind of a go-to for really brutal. Born Temujin in northern Mongolia, Genghis Khan was actually his title. He founded the Mongol Empire, where he would rule from 1206 until 1227. Khan means emperor. Since he founded the empire, he was declared Genghis, or universal ruler of the Mongols. Genghis Khan was heavily into real estate. He conquered most of Eurasia, reaching as far west as modern-day Poland and as far south as Egypt.
Now, although he is credited with uniting the Silk Road under one political system and spreading culture throughout the areas he conquered, it came at a price. Genghis killed pretty much everyone he conquered.
Everyone.
Estimates of his mass exterminations put the number dead at somewhere between 40 and 60 million people at a time when the world population was probably only about 400 million.
He killed off 10% of the world.
He was a mean guy.
He was. Carlson looks at Johnny, who's eating a brownie, and asks him why he's not on the air.
I'm a morning man, and it's 5 p.m.
Carlson knows what's going on at the station.
Art's a little disconnected sometimes. He tells them just because it's Christmas, it doesn't mean they can drop the ball.
This is a business here.
Last year you said it was a family.
Yes, well, you know, it's a family business.
Art goes on to say he's not there to win a popularity contest.
Can't do that and run a radio station at the same time, you know. Can I have one of these?
Carlson picks up one of Johnny's brownies. Johnny tells him to go ahead, eat them all. As Carlson munches on the brownie, he makes an announcement.
We just need to bear in mind that we're going to make this year's Christmas party the best Christmas party that WKRP has ever had.
Carlson takes another brownie. They must taste good.
Being ever mindful that these are hard and frugal times.
Carlson leaves the bullpen.
Now, one thing we didn't mention about edibles, it takes them longer to have an effect, and then the effect tends to last longer than smoking weed. Also, with the homemade kind, you have no idea what kind of dose you're getting, so be very careful, Art.
Andy asks if there are any more questions about bonuses.
Hey, this is Al calling from the future. When I'm editing, the audio of the show is coming from the Shout Factory discs. When Donna does the outline, she's using the Kovar discs. We work from different sources as a check to make sure we catch missing or replaced songs. In this episode, it uncovered a bonus. We found some missing lines. These are individual lines that appeared in the original as-aired version of the show, but for some reason, they were not included in the source tapes provided to Shout Factory. These were probably syndication edits designed to shorten certain scenes. This is where we caught the first one. Here's the scene as it sounds on the Shout Factory disc.
Any more questions about bonuses?
Without braces, who's going to marry my daughter?
I will, Herb.
Now, listen to what was cut.
Any more questions about bonuses?
Well, it seemed to me that He was trying to set us up for some bad news.
That's that reporter's instinct of yours, Les.
Tell Braces who's going to marry my daughter.
Still sawing on the ham, Herb voices his concern.
Tell Braces who's going to marry my daughter.
I will, Herb.
I've been kind of watching Herb sawing on that ham, and it looks like he's sawing on the bone.
I'm not seeing any meat come off. Herb stops carving. He looks up at Venus, who is smiling over his cup of eggnog. I love that little impish grin Venus gives.
Venus loves to needle Herb. So we cut to Carlson's office, where Art's sitting at his desk writing on a yellow legal pad. He's interrupted by the phone. He picks it up and tells Jennifer he can't speak to anyone right now.
I have him call me next year. February's good for him. Thank you.
Yeah, next year's good. He hangs up the phone and, yawning, reads aloud from the yellow paper on which he was just writing.
Now I know that you all feel like you should be getting a more substantial bonus this holiday season. The fact of the matter is, we just simply can't afford it. We've made improvements, but we still must continue to reinvest. To reinvest the profits. Slight profits. You know, I'm reminded of a very interesting story that Barry Buckman once told at a Kiwanis meeting. It seems that Barry's bank, his bank, which, by the way, was a member of the FDIC.
Art leans back in his chair and dozes off.
Now, Art mentioned the FDIC. This stands for Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. If you've ever heard a bank commercial, you've heard them mention the FDIC. It's insurance for your money. The FDIC was formed in 1933 in a response to bank failures during the Great Depression. It was part of the Banking Act, designed to restore faith in U.S. financial institutions. More than 5,000 member banks pay dues to the FDIC as its primary source of funding. These days, up to $250,000 are protected per account. And it works, too. Since 1933, not a single depositor has ever lost a penny of FDIC-insured funds.
Go FDIC. We hear dreamy music in the background and the sound of wind blowing. Then we hear chains dragging on the floor. There are some big production values to this episode. The lights in the studio change, and it becomes very dark behind Art. From the shadows appears an older, grayer-looking Art. He has a gray mustache and gray, bushy eyebrows. He's wearing a three-piece suit with chains around his neck. Hearing the shuffling and dragging noises, Carlson wakes up and looks at this seeming older version of himself. He sits up stunned. The two of them stare at one another, and we head into our theme.
WKRP in Cincinnati.
We come back to the lobby. Jennifer is on the phone.
I'm sorry, he's very busy. Could you call us back in February?
Jennifer hangs up the phone and opens the door to Carlson's office. Seeing Mr. Carlson dozing in his chair, she smiles and quietly closes the door.
We cut back into Art's dream. He's still staring at this ghost that looks very much like an older version of him. Then the apparition speaks.
This is your grandfather, Arthur Boy, back from the cold, dark grave.
Ah, it's Grandpa. Art shakily replies he thought he was dead.
It just said back from the cold, dark grave. Try to pay attention, okay?
And Grandfather doesn't have the balding issue that Mr. Carlson has.
No, and we were noticing that is some really good-looking hair.
It is good-looking fake hair.
From a makeup standpoint, that is some nice-looking hair on Grandpa. His grandfather begins to speak when Art interrupts him.
Wait a minute. This isn't going to be another one of those Charles Dickens Christmas Carol things, is it?
Uh-huh.
Oh, boy.
What?
And oh, yes, it's another Christmas Carol ripoff. It's hard to imagine a time before Christmas was a huge holiday and before Christmas Carol was the go-to for Hollywood parodies. Charles Dickens wrote A Christmas Carol in the fall of 1843. At the time, Christmas trees had just been introduced in England. The country was also trying to bring back Christmas carols. which had faded over the past 100 years.
Dickens wanted to celebrate Christmas, but he was also motivated by the plight of poor children in the Industrial Revolution. He had seen appalling working conditions, and he wanted to shine a spotlight on poverty and the victims of industrial growth.
The novella was a phenomenal success. The first printing of 6,000 copies sold out in 5 days just before Christmas of 1843. By the end of 1844, 13 editions had been released. Dickens is credited with creating several Christmas traditions in the story, such as taking a day off on Christmas, a Christmas family feast, dancing, games, generosity of spirit, even the turkey for Christmas dinner is a Dickens creation.
Since its introduction, the Christmas Carol novella has never been out of print, and it's been translated into several languages. Dickens himself staged public readings of the story over 120 times between 1849 and his death in 1870. The ripoffs, parodies, and adaptations are far too numerous to mention.
Carlson's grandfather says he's come to tell him to change his ways before it's too late. Carlson asks his grandfather what's wrong with his ways.
I warned you, Arthur. Because I made profit my life's work, I've been condemned to walk the face of this earth and witness the happiness that might have been.
Grandfather tells Carlson the chains around his neck are heavy suckers.
But they're not nearly as heavy as it's going to be for you lugging that control board around.
Carlson asks his grandfather how he knew about the control board.
His grandfather tells him he knows it's what Art's spending the bonus money on.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's your benefit. That's for the benefit of everybody.
Oh, who's kidding who? You're buying that control board to show your mother what a successful man you are.
Carlson tells his grandfather it's not true.
Arthur, I'm a ghost, I know.
Art says there are no such things as ghosts. He's dreaming. He starts slapping himself on the face to try and wake up as he tells his grandfather goodbye and happy holidays.
Carlson turns and sits back down at his desk.
Buster, before you wake up, you're going to be haunted by 3 ghosts.
Carlson repeats this.
Got it. 1, 2, 3. 3 ghosts.
Grandfather begins backing into the darkness as he tells Carlson to heed his words. Then asks Carlson if he has any questions. Well, Carlson says he can't wake up. His grandfather tells him he knows. Carlson continues slapping his face. He tells his grandfather Scrooge could wake up.
He didn't eat one of Johnny's brownies.
Grandfather fades into the darkness.
Art jumps up from his desk screaming for Jennifer. He runs and opens his office door.
Jennifer,
looking out into the lobby, he sees Jennifer standing there facing him. She raises her arms in a slow, flowing motion, and there's some really cool lighting happening around her. There's dreamy xylophone music echoing. Her bleached blonde hair is hanging down past her waist. She's wearing a low-cut, flowing, light lavender dress tied at the waist and a pink and purple flowered headband with lavender ribbons off the back. Art quickly goes back into his office, slamming the door.
He turns as he gets into his office, only to find Jennifer standing there waiting for him. Jennifer asks if he's ready to go.
Go where?
I am the ghost of Christmas past.
Oh, come on, Jennifer. Knock that stuff.
I am the ghost of Christmas past.
Okay, don't have to get huffy about it.
The ghost tells Carlson they must go back to a Christmas of the past.
Oh, gee, I don't know.
Come with me.
Jennifer Ghost takes Carlson's hand and closes her eyes as Carlson continues slapping his face.
Wake up, Art.
They fade from the screen, then fade back to the bullpen from the 1950s.
There are two men sitting behind old wooden desks. Now, if you'd have been watching in December of 1980, you'd have heard Perry Como's Wanted playing over the speakers.
Wanted wasn't cleared by Shout Factory. Checking in with Michael Hernandez, the accountant of rock, we find Michael listing a cover version for Wanted on the Shout Factory DVDs. It sounds like this.
Wanted, someone who kissed me.
WKRP was playing the hits even back in 1954. Wanted was recorded at the end of 1953 and released in 1954.
Wanted, someone who kissed me and held me closely, then stole my heart. Wanted, someone I trusted, who who gave no warning we'd ever part.
It went straight to number one on both the Billboard and Cashbox charts. Como's version is the most popular, but Al Martino had a top 10 hit with it in the UK, and Anne Murray did a cover of Wanted on her 1993 album, Croonin'. Wanted was written by Jack Fulton and Lois Steele.
What year is this?
It's December 24th, 1954.
Carlson looks around and points to one of the men.
Hey, that's me. I used to have Herb Darlick's job. I was sales director.
He then sees the other gentleman sitting at a desk chewing on the end of a big stogie.
And there's old Don Bassett. The meanest newsman that ever lived.
I think that would be so weird, walking into a room and seeing yourself,
yeah.
your 22-year-old self. Don Bassett is being played by Don Diamond. We've already met Brooklyn-born Don Diamond. He's a WKRP frequent flyer. Don appeared as one of the delivery guys in last year's Christmas episode, Jennifer's Home for Christmas. Go check it out for full details on Mr. Diamond.
An elderly woman looking to be close to 80 enters the bullpen.
Come on, boys. It's time to exchange our presents.
Mr. Arnold is on his way.
It's Mrs. Butterworth, the receptionist.
Mrs. Butterworth is being played by Mary Earle. Hugh Wilson likes to go to the old ladies for the laughs, doesn't he? Mary is often confused with Nedra Voles, who played Mrs. Burstyn in Pilot Part 2. Mary was born in Morrow, Ohio in, get ready for it, May of 1889.
Wow.
Yeah, her first TV appearance was on Petticoat Junction in 1967 at the age of 78.
Mary has 46 acting credits. Those include a recurring role on Green Acres. She was Mrs. Loomis on 3 episodes of The Bob Newhart Show, and she appeared on 15 episodes of The Waltons as Maud Gormley. Her actual age in this episode of WKRP is 91 years old.
Wow.
Fun trivia tidbit about Mary. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, she appeared as the little old lady from Pasadena in a series of Dodge commercials. She ended each with the catchphrase, "Put a Dodge in your garage, honey." Mary passed away in 1984 at the age of 95, and I love the way she spells her name, Mary, M-E-R-I-E.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And also, I scoured YouTube looking for her saying, "Put a Dodge in your garage, honey." I have seen those commercials before. They're amazing. She's great in them, but I could not find one. I wanted to put it in the show. The phone on young Carlson's desk rings, and young Art picks it up.
Hello. Arthur Carlson here, sales manager. Oh, hi, Mr. Finney.
His voice is crackling as if he were a teenager, and his voice is changing.
Now, based on what we know about Art's age from Patter of Little Feet, he'd be about 22 here.
And past the voice cracking stage,
yes.
I really think, yeah. He speaks to a Mr. Finney for a bit, then hangs up and tells everyone he got the Finney Volkswagen account. Mrs. Butterworth gives him a big hug as she congratulates him. Current Art leans down to Jennifer Ghost.
I was quite a salesman one day.
Now, we got to wondering, were they selling Volkswagens back in 1954? Art is getting the Finney account just as Volkswagen is becoming huge in the U.S. The Type 1, what we know as the Bug or Beetle, was designed by high-end race car engineer Ferdinand Porsche. He's considered the most important automotive design engineer of the 20th century. The first Type 1 Volkswagens, literally translated as people's car, rolled off the line in 1938. Although the Wolfsburg factory was damaged by bombing during World War II, production was revived in 1945. In 1949, 2 Beetles were sold on the East Coast of the United States. As one automotive historian says, it was like they caught fire. By 1955, more than 1 million total units had been sold in the United States. Volkswagen of America was formed to standardize U.S. sales.
The Bug holds the record as the most produced single model of any car ever. It beat out the Ford Model T for that distinction. Both cars were created for families on a budget and first-time drivers. The quirky and incredibly cheap Beetle would become the car of the hippie generation, reaching peak sales in the U.S. by 1970. Sales were driven by price and popularity, but also by the hip and cool ad campaign created by New York ad agency Doyle Dane Birnbach.
Mr. Jones and Mr. Krempler were neighbors. They each had $3,000. With his money, Mr. Jones bought himself a $3,000 car. With his money, Mr. Krempler bought himself a new refrigerator, a new range, a new washer, a new dryer, a record player, two new television sets, and a brand new Volkswagen. Now Mr. Jones is faced with that age-old problem, keeping up with the Kremplers.
If you're looking for a Volkswagen in Cincinnati today, check out Joseph Volkswagen, Fairfield Volkswagen, or King's Volkswagen.
Don Bassett voices his opinion from his desk.
Nobody's going to buy those cars. They're too small and they're too ugly. It's a fad, just like TV.
Mrs. Butterworth tells young Art his mother's going to be so proud.
Always trying to please Mom.
Mr. Armour enters carrying presents.
Oh, say, Mr. Armour. I got the Finney Volkswagen account.
Mr. Armour is being played by, and I love this name, Parley Bear. He's the only Parley on IMDb, and he might be the hardest working actor ever. Parley started on radio in 1930. He debuted on TV in 1950. Over the next 50 years, he would rack up 286 performer credits, with many of those being multiple episode arcs. He was Herb Darby on 65 episodes of Ozzie and Harriet. He was Mayor Roy Stoner on 7 episodes of The Andy Griffith Show. In his spare time, Parley created and toured with his own circuses, acting as ringmaster. Get on IMDb.com and scan down Parley's list of credits. It's pretty amazing.
And you know, looking at it, he was actually on multiple series at the same time. He was doing the recurring roles and then also stepping off and doing guest star roles on other series at the same time.
Busy guy.
It's the only way you could get that many credits in 50 years. So Mr. Armour tells him, that's great. His mother will be very proud. Then adds,
but we mustn't talk about sales. Now it's Christmas. And why won't those announcers play Christmas music? Why does it always have to be this stuff? Rock and roll.
So Mr. Armour turns off the wall speaker. Carlson tells Jennifer Ghost Mr. Armour was a great guy who'd worked in radio all his life.
Mr. Armour goes over to Mrs. Butterworth saying he's already given her a present.
A black nightgown.
She covers a little smile and looks down shyly.
Remember, 91. The woman is 91.
Mr. Armour gives Don Bassett a nicely wrapped box.
Then if it looks like a box of cigars, you're right.
Picking up a very large present, he walks over to young Carlson, saying it's for him. Young Carlson opens one end of the package and pulls out a large plastic pink flamingo. Mr. Armour excitedly tells young Carlson it's for his yard.
It's the newest thing. They're all the rage down in Florida.
Oops. They should have done a little more research here.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, the plastic pink flamingo lawn ornament wasn't invented until 1957. Don Featherstone of Union Plastics in Leominster, Massachusetts, is credited with the design. They even produced a Featherstone signature version in 1987 to celebrate the 30th anniversary of their introduction. Union Plastic ceased production of the kitsch ornaments in 2006.
Fun flamingo trivia. John Waters' 1972 movie Pink Flamingos put a spotlight on the decorations and declared the sculptures lawn kitsch. In 2009, the city of Madison, Wisconsin, adopted the pink flamingo as the city's official bird. Well, they adopted the real bird, not the plastic flamingo.
No, they adopted the plastic pink flamingo.
Oh, really?
As a joke, they did.
Okay.
It was a comment about Madison, Wisconsin. They were having some fun.
Since the 1980s, most homeowners associations have banned the birds from lawns since since they tend to drive down property values.
And through the doors comes a young Les Nessman. He's wearing a sleeveless Argyle sweater vest over a long-sleeve dress shirt, which is unbuttoned to reveal a white undershirt. He has a full head of hair.
And it looks good.
Speaking of good hair, that is some good-looking hair. He is smiling as he enters, singing Shaboom by either the Chords or the Crew Cut.
Shaboom. Shaboom.
Les dances over to Mr. Bassett.
Now, Les is singing one of the biggest hits of the day. Shaboom was first written and first recorded by Bronx doo-wop group The Chords in 1954.
Life would be a dream if I could take you up in paradise up above. If you would tell me I'm the only one that you love. Life would be a dream. Sweetheart, hello, hello again. Shaboom, and open we'll meet again, boom.
In the true tradition of whitewashed 50s hits, a more traditional take on the song was done by all-white Canadian group The Crew Cuts the same year. The Crew Cuts version was number one on the Billboard charts for 9 weeks, and it would stay on the charts for a total of 20 weeks.
Les shows him a newspaper, and pointing to an article, he tells Mr. Bassett they need to get this on the air right away. Mr. Bassett asks if it's more McCarthy stuff.
No, no, this is really important. President Ike played golf in Philadelphia. He shot an 84.
Well, get right on it, Les. Front page news.
A Philly joke. We had a run of Philly jokes in season two, but this is our first reference to Philly since Les's made-up news story for Darlene in Les's Groupie.
I'm so glad we got another Philly joke.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
In Philadelphia, thousands frightened. In Philadelphia, four dead.
In Philadelphia, local fighter nearly beaten to death.
And in Philadelphia, Archbishop Carmel was arrested again.
Finally, in Philadelphia, thousands returned to their homes peacefully.
Today in Philadelphia, thousands...
President Ike played golf in Philadelphia. He shot an 84.
So Bassett mentioned more McCarthy stuff. The Army McCarthy hearings investigating Senator Joseph McCarthy had just concluded. On December 2nd of 1954, McCarthy was censured by the Senate. He'd been accusing people of being communists and communist sympathizers since 1950. None of his accusations were ever proven, and many of his communist counts in various government agencies would change from day to day or speech to speech. McCarthy died in January of 1955 from what doctors listed as acute hepatitis. Many historians and biographers believe the condition was either caused or exacerbated by alcoholism. The timing of McCarthy's wild accusations might explain Les's ongoing paranoia about communists.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Armour gives Les his Christmas present. Les asks what it is. Mr. Armour tells him it's a tie.
A very important tie. You're no longer just an office boy. Don and I have decided to make you a real full-blown cub reporter.
Full-blown?
Les is thrilled. He holds the bow tie up to his neck.
I promise you'll never see me without a tie again.
With a huge smile on his face, Mr. Armour pulls out an envelope from his breast pocket and announces it's time for Christmas bonuses.
I'm sure Arthur's mother is not going to like this very much, but darn it, I run this radio station. And you people have got it coming.
Mr. Armour continues telling them they're a great team. He shakes hands as he gives them each their bonus checks. Les jumps up and down with excitement. Jennifer Ghost asks Mr. Carlson if he remembers what happened next.
He shouldn't have done it. That he did it without Mother's approval.
So she fired him.
Art tells her he doesn't know what other choice she had. Well, not firing him would be the other choice. As Carlson and Jennifer Ghost watch, the little group gathers around the eggnog and snacks table. Art tells Jennifer Ghost Mr. Armour was a wonderful man.
Jennifer Ghost tells Carlson it's time to go. Carlson tells everyone goodbye and wishes them all a happy new year. They disappear from the screen, then reappear in the hallway between the bullpen and the studio. Mr. Carlson hears a loud, deep voice laughing inside the bullpen.
Now, before we leave the hallway, we've got a big poster there on the door to the bullpen. It's a promo for Diana Ross's 11th studio album titled simply Diana. This was to be her last record on Motown before she moved over to RCA, where she would stay for a decade. The poster photo is also the album cover. It was taken by famed photographer Francesco Scavullo. In the 1980s, it was definitely post-disco, and Diana knew it. This album features more forward vocals, fewer drum machines, and a much leaner sound. The number one hit Upside Down and the top 10 I'm Coming Out were both from this disc.
Respectfully, I say to thee, I'm aware that you're cheating.
It is her biggest selling studio album with 10 million copies sold to date. Rolling Stone listed Diana at number 394 on their 2020 list of the 500 greatest albums of all time.
Art opens the door to peek in. We hear the Hallelujah Chorus by Handel. Mr. Carlson slams the door shut and the music stops. Mr. Carlson stands there for a moment, then opens the door, and he walks through.
Come closer, my boy.
We see Venus as the ghost of Christmas Present. He is sitting on a throne in a very dimly lit bullpen.
And Tim Reed is having so much fun.
Now, let's take a look at Venus's vibin' threads.
Venus is sitting on a large red and gold elevated throne. He has on a long red robe with white fur and gold tinsel garland around the sleeves, down the front, and around the bottom. He's wearing a leafy green headpiece with bunches of purple grapes. He also has two gold chains around his neck, a small gold ornament in his pierced left ear, several rings on his fingers, and he is holding a shiny golden goblet.
Now, King Venus's soundtrack is Handel's best-known work, the Hallelujah Chorus. It comes from his 53-movement oratorio, The Messiah. The Messiah was written over, get this, 24 days in August and September of 1741 by George Friedrich Handel. It was first performed in Dublin in April of 1742. And yeah, they said that he was so obsessed with writing it, he wasn't even eating. He lost weight during those 24 days.
My goodness.
He just had to keep writing.
That's called being driven.
Yes, definitely.
Venus is laughing and snaps his fingers, causing the Hallelujah Chorus to start up again. Venus looks at Mr. Carlson and tells him to come on in. Carlson closes the door as Venus wiggles his finger at him, telling him to come closer, laughing. Carlson hesitantly sidesteps his way over to Venus.
You must be the ghost of Christmas Present.
Say what?
I said you must be the ghost of Christmas Present.
That's right.
Can you turn down this music?
Sure.
Venus snaps his fingers, and the music stops.
Damn, that's fun. Boy, that's fun.
Art, impressed, asks if he can do that.
I'm sorry, see, you got to be a ghost. You're just some guy having a dream.
Nah, you got to be a ghost. So Mr. Carlson asks Venus Ghost if he can turn up the lights, maybe. Venus Ghost says,
sure,
and snaps his fingers. Nothing happens. He snaps again. Still nothing. He snaps a third time, and this time the lights come on. Smiling, Venus Ghost asks Art what he can do for him.
Well, aren't you going to take me somewhere?
Don't have to. We can do it right here.
Laughing, Venus Ghost starts to get down from his elevated chair. He asks Art to hold his golden goblet, then he steps down.
Give me.
Venus Ghost grabs his goblet back from Art.
Venus Ghost looks at Mr. Carlson.
Excuse me.
Venus Ghost snaps his fingers. The throne and Mr. Carlson disappear from the screen. Venus Ghost looks up, surprised, and he starts looking around. Mr. Carlson has reappeared across the room, standing in a chair in Les's office.
Somehow I feel you're new at this stuff.
And, you know, I think Art was touching the throne is the reason he got stuck in that snap.
I think you're right.
Yeah, he reached up and touched it.
Herb comes into the bullpen. Herb is upset and talking to himself.
Worship. I must be awake. There's Herb.
kowtow to him. I am his number one yes man lackey. And what do I get for it? Nothing. Zippo. Uno zero.
Uno zero? What's uno zero?
I don't know. Herb is angrily punching a number into his phone.
Bailey enters. She's complaining loudly.
Knocked myself out and worked three times as hard as any man, and this is the things I get.
I love how she changes twice to three as she sees Herb.
So she pulls out the chair at her desk and sits down. Venus Ghost looks at Art.
These are your employees, Mr. Carlson. We're a great team if there ever was one.
Art walks over behind Herb and listens in on the conversation Herb is having with his wife.
Oh, Lucille, guess what, babe? We're not getting bonuses again this year. I don't know why.
We're a family business, huh? Where hard-nosed decisions have to be made, right, AC?
Herb continues on the phone with Lucille.
I guess when she grows up, we'll just have to put her in a convent.
Poor Bunny going to a convent. The ghost tells Art Herb was going to get braces for his daughter with that bonus money.
Les enters the bullpen and goes over to Bailey, telling her one of them is going to have to work Christmas Day. They can't decide who is going to work, and they agree to flip a coin. Les flips a coin in the air, and he catches it. Les announces that it's heads, but neither of them called it. Bailey takes the coin and tells Les to call it.
It's tails,
Venus Ghost says before Bailey catches the coin. Les calls tails. Bailey catches the coin and looks at it.
Heads.
She's lying.
Bailey tells Les that she'll work. Les starts to protest. She tells him she wants to work.
That's the spirit.
And at first, Art is like, all right, great. But then he finds out Bailey says she can't fly home because she doesn't have a bonus. She can't afford it now. Les tells her okay as she plops down in her desk chair. Les continues to stand by her side.
Bailey, did you try to steal my quarter?
Bailey stands up, pulls the quarter from her jacket pocket and tells him, yes, she did try to steal his quarter. Andy's come into the bullpen.
Andy, I just tried to steal a quarter from Les.
And he asks her why. Les asks Andy why he can't talk to Art about the bonuses. Andy said he just tried, but Carlson was taking a nap. Bailey comments she doesn't see how he can sleep.
It's the brownies.
Yeah, we know why he's sleeping.
Yeah. Bailey tells Andy she got 3 job offers this past year, one of them actually for money. She needs to start thinking about herself.
Throwing the carving knife down on his desk, Herb jumps up and walks over to where the others are standing.
Hey, it's Al again. This is where we found another one of those syndication edits, and this is a big one. They cut out one of our favorite never-seen recurring characters. Big Dick Musham, Herb's neighbor and seeming business mentor, got a name check in this sequence originally, but it was cut in the Shout Factory version. Check it out. This is the sequence as it appears on the Shout Factory disc.
I mean, radio is my life. But I swear, wholesale appliances is where the money is.
You know, Andy, if people could just feel somehow as if they were sharing the station's progress.
And this is what we found on Dale Kovar's amazing set of recreated discs.
I mean, radio is my life. But I swear, wholesale appliances is where the money is. My neighbor, Big Dick Mushroom, he wants me to go in with him. And I'll tell you something else. I just might take him up on it.
You know, Andy, if people could just feel somehow as if they were sharing the station's progress.
Herb tells him that his neighbor, Big Dick Musham, has asked him to go into business with him.
Another reference to BDM, Big Dick Musham.
Les tells Andy it would be nice if people could just feel they were sharing in the station's progress.
Some things are more important than money.
Andy tries to explain.
Carlson is what?
Go on.
Well, he's... Go on! Cheap, right.
Oh, what?
He's a scandal. He's a type one. What else can I say?
You hear Venus Ghost laughing as Art tells him he doesn't want to see any more of this.
Can I go back to my office?
I think you deserve it.
Whatever you say, AC.
Venus Ghost snaps his fingers, and we find ourselves looking at Mr. Carlson's very dim office, his empty chair behind his desk. Suddenly, Carlson appears standing beside his desk chair. We can hear Venus Ghost's laughter echoing. Art's waving his arms around as he yells.
That's it for me. I don't want to see anymore. To heck with the control board. Where's my checkbook?
Carlson begins digging through his desk drawers. He empties out his collection of toys that we've seen before from his drawers as he looks for the checkbook.
The back of a hand, fingers splayed, appears in front of the camera as we're watching Mr. Carlson toss toys out of his desk drawer. Mr. Carlson turns, and he thinks he sees Johnny.
Aha, yeah, you're too late, Fever.
I'm writing out personal checks, going to reimburse myself later.
Johnny tells him his name is not Fever.
That's right. You'd be the ghost of the Christmas future.
At your service.
Judging from your outfit, my future's not too bright.
Fever Ghost tells him he's right. Carlson tells the ghost he doesn't want to see it. Fever Ghost tells him he must see it. Mr. Carlson tells him he's doing away with the control board, and he's writing out checks so he can just go on home. The ghost tells Carlson this trip is not to get him to write the checks.
This trip is for you to understand the true spirit of giving. It's to teach you goodwill among men, peace on earth, God rest you merry gentlemen, joy to the world, adeste fidelis.
I love the detail. Ghost Fever is carrying a black coffee mug. That is so cool.
He's got to. It goes with his outfit.
The ghost tells Carlson this trip is also to decide just how big those checks will be.
You ghosts never give up, do you?
Carlson tells the ghost if it wasn't for Johnny Fever's brownies, he wouldn't even be in this dream right now anyway.
Oh, lighten up, AC. There's nothing wrong with those brownies. Just because it was Johnny. Everyone always jumps to the wrong conclusions. Poor Johnny.
The ghost goes on talking about how poor Johnny is always so misunderstood. Art interrupts, asking the ghost if they could just go. Fever Ghost takes a long sip from his cool black coffee mug and stares upward. Art follows his gaze, and they both fade from the picture.
Mr. Carlson and Fever Ghost reappear in an all-white setting where there is one desk. An older version of Herb Tarlick sits reading a girly magazine.
And it's called Girls, the Way You Like 'Em.
Carlson asks the ghost where they are. He's told this is the bullpen. Carlson tells them that it looks like there have been some changes. The call letters, WKRP, are in neon blue tube lighting in the background. At the desk, old Herb moves a couple of knobs on a control board in front of him. Then he goes back to reading his girly magazine, using a magnifying glass for a bit, as we listen to a pre-recorded message making a sales call.
Good morning. This is the Xeroid Corporation of Cincinnati, Ohio.
Hello, Herb Tarlick here, General Sales Manager of WKRP in Cincinnati.
Hello, Herb.
I'm going to ask if your company would like to advertise on our station.
No, thank you, Herb.
Perhaps I could call back next week.
Yes, Herb. Please do that. This has been a computerized transmission.
Okay, fine.
After watching this scene, Carlson asks the Fever Ghost how far into the future they are seeing. The ghost tells him, not as far as you might think.
I think if you need a magnifying glass for the girly mags, it's time to give up the girly mags. Somebody's got to talk to Herb. So Art asks where everybody is.
The entire station has been automated. Herb is the only employee. There's no one else here. Kind of a warm feeling, isn't it?
Carlson asks about Bailey, Les, Travis. The ghost tells Carlson one by one he sort of forced him to quit.
Bailey runs a television station in Chicago now. Travis is breeding guard dogs in New Mexico. Venus owns a clothing company called Upwardly Mobile. Jennifer married, bought herself an entire island off the coast of Sardinia. And Les Nessman, the Republican whip of the United States Senate.
Carlson asks the ghost about Johnny Fever and himself. The ghost tells him Fever just sort of disappeared. So Art asks about himself. Then he tells the ghost no, he doesn't want to know.
Old Herb stretches and stands up from the desk. He begins turning things off on the control board. The ghost explains to Mr. Carlson that Herb talks to himself quite a bit now.
It's going to be a nice Christmas. Little Herbie home from the forestry service. Bunny home from the convent. We'll all be together again.
Old Herb walks away from the desk mumbling, it sure isn't like the old days. Mr. Carlson turns to Fever Ghost and he pleads with him.
Doesn't it feel this way, does it?
I don't have to die friendless.
The ghost tells him that they say people change their destinies just by missing a bus. Carlson grabs Fever Ghost by his upper arms, saying that things can change. Things can be different. Carlson falls to his knees, hugging Fever Ghost around the legs, begging him to take him back.
You must change your ways, AC, or else it will all end like this. Not a pretty picture.
Come on, Fever, give me a break.
The scene fades with Mr. Carlson saying over and over, he doesn't want to die.
We fade up on Art, still on his knees, only this time he's hugging Jennifer's knees. He's in tears as he's begging. Jennifer is patting Art softly on his shoulders as she calls his name. He stands up, happy to see it's really Jennifer.
Then it's over. The dream is over.
Jennifer assures him whatever it was, it's all over now. Art's giddy as he asks Jennifer, where's his checkbook? She tells him it's in the left drawer. He gets the checkbook and opens it as he asks Jennifer, when's the Christmas party? She tells him in about 20 minutes.
Oh, that's wonderful, and I got plenty of time.
Jennifer tells him it was just a dream. There were no ghosts.
Johnny comes to the office door and tells Mr. Carlson, Merry Christmas. Carlson runs over to Johnny, giggling.
Merry Christmas, Johnny. Merry Christmas. I saw ghosts. real ghosts.
Carlson is giddy as he continues.
You know, success at the expense of your friend is not success at all. It's better to give than to receive. That stuff's true. So I'm going to get big bonuses this year.
Flashing the rock-on symbol with both hands, Carlson repeats.
Big bonuses.
Putting the check ledger under his arm, Carlson walks over to Johnny and Jennifer.
Mother probably won't like this, but darn it, I'm running the station. And you people have got it coming.
Art walks over to Johnny and puts a hand on Johnny's shoulder.
Those brownies, I want them. Take those things over to Mother's house and I'll put one under Barcini.
Laughing uncontrollably, he tells them he'll see them at the Christmas party, and he dances out of his office singing. Jennifer walks up to Johnny and, boom, just kisses him on the lips.
Merry Christmas.
She walks out smiling. Johnny's frozen in disbelief for a moment, then kind of realizing what happened, he smiles.
God bless us, everyone.
He tosses his mug in the air and catches it as the screen goes to black.
God bless us, everyone, is the blessing Tiny Tim gave before the meal in A Christmas Carol. Dickens repeats the line as the last line of the story. Interesting tidbit, Dickens tried out other names for Tim in earlier drafts, such as Little Fred and Tiny Mick, before finally landing on Tiny Tim as the character name.
Can you imagine?
I kind of like Tiny Mick, though.
Tiny Mick, but can you imagine? Tiny Tim Fred? Is so ingrained in the zeitgeist. How could it be anyone other than Tiny Tim?
Little Fred.
Little Fred. And we don't get the going to a bartender closing theme. The closing credits are shown as we see the WKRP staff eating, drinking, and dancing in the bullpen, but the song playing is Jingle Bells, Sleigh Ride by the Living Voices.
Hear those sleigh bells jingling, ring-ting-tingling too. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. Outside the snow is falling and friends are calling you
who. And that's going to do it for Bah Humbug. What is up for next week, Donna?
Grab your winter coat, baby. It's cold inside. The heat has gone out at the Flynn Building, but Johnny has ideas of his own on how to keep his coworkers warm. And we get another visit from Mama.
Always love seeing Mama. And that's going to be our first episode of 1981. That's going to do it for this episode of the WKRP cast. If you'd like to watch along with us, make sure to check our show notes. Find us on social media. You can follow our Facebook page at WKRP cast. And for more WKRP fun, become a patron. Go to patreon.com/WKRPcast for behind-the-scenes fun, full interviews, and more.
Got a question, comment, or correction? Let us know about it. Write us, WKRPcast@gmail.com.
And remember to please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Bye, y'all.
May the good news be yours.
The WKRP cast is not endorsed by MTM Enterprises, Shout Factory, or CBS. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. WKRP in Cincinnati, the WKRP logo, and all names, pictures, and audio of WKRP in Cincinnati characters are registered trademarks of MTM, CBS, Shout Factory, or their respective copyright holders.
Almost forgot, fellow babies. Booger!